Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When the World Health Organization recently announced it was officially recognizing something called gaming disorder, it made waves around the world. Here's WHO spokesperson Tagik Yashagovich in Geneva, Switzerland.
Gaming disorder, we believe, can affect anyone equally, the younger generation and older generation. It is important that people who engage in gaming, but also their family and friends, recognize impaired control over gaming, problems in social behavior, meaning that gaming takes precedence over normal activities such as family activities, schooling, friend activities. Family and friends, if they notice that, try really to speak to the person and try to seek professional help.
But what might that professional help entail? And who can get it if American medical societies and insurance companies don't yet recognize the disorder? And what's the difference between a problematic habit and an out-of-control disorder? And is addictive gaming the problem or a symptom of a different problem? Lastly, what should partners, loved ones, and parents do if they suspect someone close to them has a problem? We're going to look at all of that today with Dr. David Ratu, director of the Pediatric Psychiatry Clinic at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Ratu, nice to have you back on the program.
Nice to be back, Jane.
All right. So as we heard, the WHO says gaming disorder could be a culprit when someone has an out-of-control gaming problem that they engage in to the detriment of other activities, that it's affecting schooling or jobs or sleep, it's affecting relationships. And they say that this has to have been in place for a year before it's an official diagnosis. What are the other hallmarks that we should know of about a gaming disorder?
Well, as you said, the diagnosis describes people basically who become consumed with playing video games at the exclusion of other parts of their lives. And the diagnosis comes in the tradition of other substance abuse or other addictive disorders like gambling disorder. And it has three main components. One is that the gaming is taking an increased priority in somebody's life, and that means over things such as eating and sleeping and working and going to school, that there is a feeling that the gaming is somewhat out of someone's control. There's a real compulsive quality to it. And thirdly, that the gaming is continuing despite there being obvious negative consequences to playing at this level.
It doesn't say, for example, how many hours somebody needs to be playing per day for it to fall into the level of disorder. Is that particular type of lack of specificity a good thing because it allows for more flexibility? Or, you know, would this be fleshed out more as it becomes a more well-known diagnosis?
Well, people have argued both. There's a trend in the diagnostic criteria to move away from hard cutoffs. You see that in some other disorders where they've gotten rid of some of these hard cutoffs. And most of us consider this to be a good thing because each person it's so idiosyncratic that it gives us more leeway to really make a good clinical judgment based on an individual person.
What do you think of this diagnosis, this official designation by the WHO of a gaming disorder?
Well, overall, I don't have a big problem with it. I think it's useful. I certainly see in my own practice people who struggle with video games, and I know that there are people where it does become all-consuming. But at the same time, I can see why it's controversial, and like most diagnoses in our mental health system, it's far from perfect.
Where are the controversies?
I see the controversies coming from two main directions. One are people who kind of roll their eyes and say, here we go. Here's another normal thing that people do that the doctors are turning into a disease. So I think that's one direction. The other direction comes from a lot of people who like to play video games and from the video game industry who feel singled out that this particular activity is being designated as a disorder when we know that there are other things, other activities that people do that can become obsessive. I was just talking to a physician yesterday and he was talking about how he sees people who seem to watch cable news obsessively and, you know, pornography and, you know, things like even golf people can take to an extreme level. We don't have a golfing disorder. And so I think some people feel like this is an indictment of video games in general.
But you don't?
Well, I think that there is something specific about video games. I certainly would agree that there are other things that can become as obsessive. But to me, it's a little disingenuous of the industry to first design games to be so captivating and then to complain when people notice that their efforts are actually working. You can't really have it both ways in my mind.
So there is, you think, something different about gaming that's specifically different than somebody who, I don't know, what looks at Facebook 100 times a day.
Sure. And I do think that there are people who compulsively use Facebook as well. But there was an interesting TED Talk that I saw by somebody who struggled with a video game addiction and then overcame it. And he pointed out four aspects of gaming that I think are useful. And this may explain why video games in particular may be so captivating to some people. One, it's a very good escape from everyday life. Second, increasingly it's becoming more of a social activity, and social in a way that might be more comfortable for some people than the typical traditional types of social interactions. Third, there's very much of a challenge. There's a mission and a purpose that people can really feel a part of. And fourth, you make measurable progress. You get better. You know that you're getting better, and that it builds a sense of accomplishment.
All of those, though, are good things in a lot of ways, too. And as you said, those are reasons people want to play and want to be engaged and aren't necessarily in and of themselves a problem in any way.
Sure. And this definition, this disorder, is not meant to capture those people. This is really designed to capture a minority of even people who consider them to be avid video games players or gamers.
Dr. Ratu, one of the other questions has been, if the gaming itself is the problem, or if it's a symptom of some other underlying mental health issue like anxiety or depression, so how would you tease those things apart?
That's a great point, and I've seen it work in both directions. So in other words, people who struggle with depression or extreme anxiety, that may be the primary problem, and video games is certainly a place for these folks to go to occupy their time. But that's different than the person who really has a gaming disorder. And so there may be times where it's really hard to disentangle those two things, but the development will often be different. You're sort of asking questions to get at whether or not someone is moving towards video games or away from other parts of their life. And so people who primarily have depression or anxiety, the video games are filling a gap, but they don't describe this. They're thinking about the games all the time. They're playing at all hours of the night. You know, there isn't this sort of building intensity that you would sometimes hear with gaming disorder.
We got a note from Lara who says, it seems nearly every man I have been in a relationship with over the past 25 years has been consumed on some level by video games. I could guess the amount of hours per day would be around 4 to 5, and on his phone or computer or a game console at home. And it's everywhere we go, be it a restaurant, bar, in a vehicle, or while watching TV and movies at home. A 40-something adult with a full-time job, that adds up to 28 to 35 hours per week. That's like a part-time job itself. It's not for me to judge or suggest what these men should be doing with their time, but it's difficult to imagine the collective hours of life adult gamers and kids squander, literally twiddling their thumbs. There is so much more out there to actually be doing with one's time. Do you have suggestions on how to encourage guys or anyone engulfed in video games to get out from under the game cloud a little bit more? Now, is Laura, you know, this is not necessarily the sign of a gaming disorder, right? This may be somebody who it sounds like is impeding particular relationships. But, you know, there is this line, Dr. Ratu, that we've been talking about between somebody who likes to play a lot and somebody who actually has an out of control disorder.
Right. It doesn't necessarily say one or the other. And if you think about it, almost all pastimes, if you're not somebody who's really involved in it, they can sound pretty silly. I mean, getting back to golf, you're, you know, running around, spending all day, putting a ball into a little cup. So,
I know some people who will spend 25 to 30 hours a week knitting, and they'll do it while watching TV and videos. They'll do it in the car when somebody else is driving. They'll do it when they're having conversations with somebody, and we're not calling it a knitting disorder.
Sure, right. So that, I think, gets at some of the controversy. But I think the comment also points out that this is something that you typically tend to see in males more than females. But it is a smaller population of people than, you know, the disorder might suggest. And, you know, in terms of what to do about it, one of the recommendations is, before really getting judgmental, and it's very easy, believe me, to get judgmental about video games and the amount of time being pursued, is to try to understand them in your child or in your partner. and not just immediately go to, you got to stop this. Find out. Video games are actually really different from each other. They're not all the same, and they're captivating for different reasons. Some of them are really about, you know, mythical worlds. Others are much more about battle and warfare. What is it? Ask the question, what is it about the games that are so captivating? And then try to think about the process of whether or not there are other things that might be that might capture some of those same things that don't involve video games. And it's not so simple to just say, go out and play. I mean, that makes for a nice tweet. But I think if you're a parent, you sometimes need to actually put in some effort to help bridge from video games to other activities, because some of these kids literally do not know what to do other than video games.
You mentioned prevalence and that it is a very small number of people who have a significant medical problem or a problem that needs treatment when it comes to this. And the WHO admits that it doesn't really have statistics on this either. Here again is Tagik Yashagovic with the WHO in Geneva.
We don't really have prevalence data. This is something that will be looked at in the future. For example, gaming disorder will be listed along gambling disorder. And we know that gambling disorder affects anywhere between less than 1% to several percent of general population. So prevalence data will come with the time and with the fact that we get to know more about this. Inclusion of gaming disorder into international classification of diseases is really a signal to health professionals that there is an issue and that they can look for indicators that would let them believe that the person has gaming disorder.
Dr. Ratu, would you be comfortable diagnosing somebody with a gaming disorder? I mean, is that a diagnosis that you feel comfortable with making?
Yeah, I think I would. The point brings up this interesting idea that generally when a diagnosis is made, we come up with new diagnoses because there are data about prevalence and statistics and treatment. And in this case, it's sort of working in reverse. People are saying, well, let's make the disorder first, and that will hopefully foster more people to study it. So it is working backwards. It's not unique to gaming disorder, but it is a little different.
Let's go to Justin calling in from Essex. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hey there, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been an avid gamer since childhood, basically. I've played serious games from World of Warcraft to Hearthstone. I hate Fortnite. It just seems like the media is always really, really eager to blame video games for all manner of social challenge, from school shootings to antisocial behavior, despite evidence to the contrary.
Well, so Justin, I totally get that it's frustrating, and definitely don't want to be part of demonizing something unnecessarily, but also want to point out this is the World Health Organization that's making this diagnosis, and I'm curious for you, you know, have you seen people for whom you think, okay, you have a problem? You know, maybe for you, Justin, this is something that is a really big and important and good part of your life. Do you see people for whom, like anything, like alcohol, like gambling, it is more of a problem?
In my personal experience, I mean, World of Warcraft is a great example. Hours and hours, you know, all free time devoted to it. But that, it always felt very social for me. So I don't feel like I've ever seen an example of that that wasn't under the umbrella of parenting and, you know, people being social and being active, you know, in life. So it's hard to blame video games for, say, being on the spectrum, finding a world that accepts you, finding a world you can be anything you want in. How is that so bad?
Yeah, Justin, I really appreciate you making that point and bringing up your own experience with it. Thank you very much for that. Let's get another perspective in here from Xavier in Brattleboro. Hi, Xavier. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm actually somebody that's struggled with a gaming disorder in the past. And I've got to admit that a lot of it came from the fact that just I had difficulties forming interpersonal relationships due to difficulties in the early years of my life. And it kind of gave me something to focus on and work towards, which a lot of that you don't see outside of school. And I think it's definitely something that we need to focus on. Not everybody that games heavily necessarily is somebody like myself, but it's also something you can get under control with some work.
Xavier, do you mind if I ask you, how did you get it under control for yourself? Because it sounds like this was something that you were using as a tool, but also recognizing that it was a problem for you.
I've spent a lot of my time either trading away consoles or getting rid of my computers or just taking a large break. Sometimes from it would range from 3 days of a break to up to 3 months, depending on how bad I was doing at that point.
So what advice do you have for people who may be struggling with the same things that you were, or who find themselves or find their kids or their loved ones in that kind of situation?
A lot of it is just turning the mirror back around and looking at yourself. There's something that you can do to strengthen yourself and fortify that belief that there's other things that you can seek out there than just personal reward in video games.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, Xavier, to call us and to share your personal experience with this. Thanks very much. Dr. Ratu, when it comes to gaming, as we've just been discussing, there aren't really good statistics. But do you have a sense of how a developing child's brain might fare with something like a gaming disorder differently than an adult, or is there no distinction?
Well, I think kids in general learn how to self-regulate. That's a really important process. And in the beginning, as a child is developing, they need other people to help do that for them, and then those skills develop. So for kids and for adolescents, I think it's useful for there to be some limits and controls. And then as kids get older, they transfer a lot of that regulation onto themselves.
We hear sometimes that addiction can be sparked in young people because of their developmental stages and because of the way their brain is working, and that delaying certain things can help make sure that they're not as likely to become addicted, whether it's to alcohol or drugs or other substances. Is that true for gaming too? I mean, gaming is really prevalent among young people, but is it something that we should be thinking about delaying somewhat or putting those kinds of breaks on more carefully?
Well, official groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics have come out and said that they really want to limit screen time and includes video games and then limit the amount after, say, age two. I think there still needs to be better research on this. I would love to think that putting some reasonable limits on kids helps them regulate themselves later in life, but I actually have not seen a whole lot of evidence to say that that's certainly true or not.
Let's go to Anne DeMarle, who's the director of Emergent Media Center at Champlain College, which is, a leader in gaming as a degree. Anne, it's nice to talk with you again.
Yeah. Hi, Dane.
Hi.
How you doing?
Is this something that you think about at Champlain College as you work with young people who are really at the forefront of the technology and all aspects of gaming?
Oh, well, we always consider all the aspects, I think, of games. So not just addiction, but how young people use it to create really positive efforts in their lives. One of the things, I think you jumped the gun on me, I wanted to point out that the DSM really is calling for this needing further study. And likewise, there was a response to the WHO where 36 researchers said, wait a minute, it's not a disorder. We need better studies on it yet. And so I would agree with that that piece there, that it really does need further study before it can be called a disorder. I also think that if you look at it statistically, I know your presenter says that there aren't solid figures, but people are saying maybe 1-3% of video gamers might be addicted. So, you know, I look at that in comparison to something like the opioid crisis, which I think any person on opioids who's prescribed them, the addiction rate is so much higher that we need to look at it with a grain of salt.
But let me ask you, Anne, because I'm curious, you know, what I guess one of the differences is, you know, nobody is getting a major in how to produce an opiate.
Drugs? Sure there are.
Well, they're getting a chemistry degree. They're not taking the drugs. But so the question for me is, with you is, you know, how do you think of this when, sure, you know, absolutely granted, in college we look at all kinds of addictive behavior that's detrimental to the student experience and to a person. And alcohol is for sure a huge one. But you find schools saying, okay, well, this is how we're trying to address it. This is how we're dealing with it. So I'm curious if this is something that you address, because if 1-3% has an addiction or a possible addiction, How do you weed them out? How do you help students who are starting to veer into that territory?
Right. You know, Jane, I would say that we don't even see that 1-3% within our student body. I mean, if you think about it, that we have one of the top game programs in the United States, and, you know, a big proportion of Champlain students are in technology majors or in game majors. You know, our number is really, really low in that perspective. So, I think we as a college look at more mental health across the campus, and it's not isolated to this one particular piece. And then also I'd say we look at it by, you know, the work that we do at the Emergent Media Center. We're using games to create positive change. So the students here are working on things, issues such as violence against women and girls, PTSD. We're doing a surgical simulation for surgeons. And we're also working with the Stern Center to gamify an online course to teach people how to be better parents of young babies, you know, pre-K. So how do you interact? I mean, to your last question, how do you interact with your young children? So we look at it as a whole, and how can technology drive the good?
So do you agree with Justin?
So that's what I look at.
Do you agree with the caller, Justin, who said, I feel like this is vilifying gaming unnecessarily?
Yes and no. I wouldn't put it vilifying. I think it does need study. I also think back to an earlier comment about Facebook and technology and to our mobile devices. We really do need to look at how technology is impacting our daily lives and our choices as a culture, for instance. One of my pet peeves is to watch a parent pushing a stroller while they're on their cell phone and they're not interacting with their baby. I do believe you need to interact with your children. So as parents, how do you promote that? When I was a younger parent, my daughter is now 30, and I've been in the game area for at least 20 years. I did limit screen time, all kinds of screen time, and I made sure that I knew what she was doing online. I think we don't do that as much, so I wouldn't just put the games out there. I would look at culturally how are we using our screen time overall, and how are we parenting? And I think those are bigger factors impacting our youth today. Mm. You know, is where they're getting those social cues from. I think in general, what I see more with the gaming culture is that's a place where young people connect to each other, and they form social bonds. And, you know, it might seem strange to folks of a different generation, but if you find a community that you can creatively play with, it's really lacking in day-to-day life for our youth. You know, they don't have that area to go play with friends anymore.
Well, Anne, I appreciate your perspective on this as somebody who's been working in this field and works to train the next generation of game makers and game developers and people working in this field as well. That's Anne DeMarle, who's the director of the Emergent Media Center at Champlain College. Thanks very much, Anne.
Thank you.
And let's go to Sebastian, who's calling in from Waltham. Hi, Sebastian. Go right ahead.
Hello. So my name is Sebastian Crowell. I am a 21-year-old who's also mostly suffering from this gaming disorder as well. From my knowledge, I just have a certain question that's been going in my head while I was listening to this podcast. And so as we talk about this gaming disorder, comparing other disorders, involving certain medication wise and insurance. Because we also tend to talk about this gaming disorder reflects on other disorders as well. Do you think that, if there's medication for this gaming disorder, what are the certain medication that it should be for this gaming disorder? And if not, how would the insurances cover or not cover for it?
Yeah, Sebastian, thanks for the call. And Dr. Ratu, let's start first with this question of, you know, if we're saying this is a medical diagnosis and there's treatment that then is prescribed. Is there a medication that's also sometimes perhaps that might go along with treatment for gaming disorder?
Well, if we think gaming disorder is controversial now, just wait till they come up with a medication to treat it. Right now, there are no FDA-approved medications for gaming disorder. It's so new. And what people are doing is if in the course of an evaluation are finding that somebody meets criteria for something else, they're treating with that something else. Now, it wouldn't shock me if some pharmaceutical company does come out with something, and it probably would be kind of a retasking of existing medications that are already being used for things like anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder. But we'll see.
And I'm going to hold the insurance question for a moment, but Sebastian, I promise we'll come back to it because that's a really interesting piece of this as well. But I want to bring in Rachel Stark, who's director of admissions and outreach at Spring Lake Ranch in Cuttingsville. And this is a long-term residential program for adults with mental health and addiction. Rachel Stark, first of all, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Jane.
And you are seeing people coming in reporting that they have a problem with gaming?
We are. Actually, it's kind of been born out of the last 5 years. More and more of the young adults that come to us come with a component that includes gaming or overall device addiction, processing device addiction. And they're presenting with exacerbated anxiety, sometimes depression, very much failure to launch, reverse sleep cycles, and overwhelmingly social issues, inability to connect with another human being. So we, by default, have been running into this increasingly over the years. It hasn't been specified, except for in one situation, as gaming disorder, because, again, it is not recognized in the United States. But more and more, it's becoming part of the narrative that accompanies an individual that comes in, and we've witnessed it here, as we're a therapeutic community where connections with other human beings is very much part of the curative power of this place. And by default, we've had to change our internet rules over the years to, you know, compensate for this, because left to their own devices, many of our clients would prefer to interact with their computer than with one another.
So what do you do in that case? You take away the computers? You limit internet activity?
We're learning as we go. So the first thing we did was eliminate cell phones because the portability of smartphones make them hard to manage, so we just don't allow them at all. The next step we took was to limit the internet hours so that they did not conflict with the core of what we do. And we work. We have our clients work 5 hours a day here on the ranch.
Like manual labor type stuff.
Manual labor, yeah, but it's fun. It's not slave labor. They split wood. They build barns. They herd cattle. It's all, generally, I like to think, uplifting kind of stuff. But it's to get them moving, active, engaging with one another and the staff, of course. But even that, when we've set aside certain hours where the internet is available, because we have some people in school, some people who use gaming for, you know, somewhat medicinal purposes, they argue, to quell depression, anxiety, make connections with other human beings. So we've heard both sides of the argument, mind you. But we've seen that they would, you know, if there's too many conflicting activities, it's usually the internet that wins out. You know, if yoga's being offered and a trip to the movies, they still would choose to go on the internet. So we've been playing with this quite a bit over the years and continue to explore what's the most beneficial. We have had situations, and recently so, where someone had a very clearly identified, although not nationally accepted, gaming addiction, and that individual, we said, you know what, we all know this going in, no computer for the first month that you're here. I'm going to teach you how to, you know, reintegrate with your fellow human beings, and it's been a very interesting experiment for that individual because it's hard for them to watch others on their computer and not be tempted. So it's very much, more will be revealed as more research is presented and we're learning our way, but the accepted therapies right now to treat not just gaming but device addiction is usually CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and more rehabs. And we're not a rehab, we're primary mental health. It's about that underlying why people do what they do. But more and more rehabs, drug and alcohol rehabs, are layering on specialty areas where they can deal with this as well. So it's very much just beginning to be addressed in a more formal way through different modalities.
Well, Rachel, I appreciate you sharing a little bit what happens at Spring Lake Ranch, and it's interesting to hear about it in a therapeutic session or situation. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
That's Rachel Stark. She's Director of Admissions and Outreach at Spring Lake Ranch, and again, that's in Cuttingsville. And so, Dr. Ratu, one of the main questions here, and Sebastian brought it up, is insurance. So the WHO recognizes this as a gaming disorder. It's not in the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Health, which is what is often used for diagnosis, but also for insurance. So are people going to be able to get insurance coverage for treatment for gaming disorder?
Eventually, yes. And there is a distinction between the DSM system and the ICD system, which is what the World Health Organization is talking about. In some ways, though, it's not as much of a practical problem, because usually you can find some other code that you can use to get people to have treatment. But certainly having a specific disorder that you can write down and compel an insurance company to reimburse will certainly help. And that's one of the reasons why people argue that we need more of an official designation for gaming disorder.
Gaming's not going away. And if anything, we see people of all different kinds and in all different kinds of technology becoming more and more addicted to their technology, whether it's, you know, you should be going to bed, but you're checking Facebook, you're checking social media sort of obsessively at midnight, or, you know, people who are gaming. So if we're seeing more of this as part of our culture, do you expect to see more people having a significant medical problem with it that could be a disorder? Or are we already starting to see sort of a curbing of that activity and breaks that are being put in by the producers of this technology to make sure that we're not getting too addicted to it?
My sense is that we still have a ways to go, and I think some of the comments that we've heard today suggest that the gaming industry still sort of perceives any critique, the idea that anybody could be struggling with their products, as sort of an indictment of the entire industry. And I think that that's unfortunate. Hopefully that the industry will mature and be able to acknowledge that just because we know that some people struggle with this, that doesn't mean that we are negatively passing judgment on the entire existence of video games.
Well, it's interesting stuff. And as you said, we shall see. I mean, this is something that's still being developed and still being analyzed and assessed. Dr. Ratu, David Ratu, is director of the Pediatric Psychiatry Clinic at the University of Vermont Medical Center. And you'll find him on social media with the handle PediPsych. Thank you so much for talking with us again, Dr. Ratu.
My pleasure.